Alrighty, so The Politics of the French, Part 2, Rousseau. We're breaking this up into three sections. His book, The Origin of Inequality. The Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, that's one. And then The Social Contract, his book on political theory. And then, if we have time, and I'm going to insist that we have time, because it's a short section, but some interesting things about his book, Emile, which is a novel, but it's on education. And it creates an educational theory that I think is very influential on a surprising amount of people. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, his dates are 1712 to 1778. Interesting right away, just his biography, how that tells a story. He grew up in Geneva, and he would change history in Paris. He would live out an anti-Calvin metaphor with his life. The reformer, John Calvin, physically went one way, from France to Geneva. The revolutionary philosopher physically, geographically went the other way, from Geneva to France. Calvin fled France being awakened from the depravity of man to the glory of God. Rousseau walked the other way, running out from under the shadow of the reformer to the vanity of human potential. Now, what might trip us up is that this is not the human potential of the Enlightenment proper. Rousseau is going to disagree with the Enlightenment. But the vision of man between the two, Calvin and Rousseau, was diametrically opposed in terms of sin. There's some other differences too, but that's the root difference. You're going to see Rousseau fleeing from the Calvinistic doctrine of man in sin. And yet, Rousseau was pessimistic about man in modern society. Rousseau is going to be optimistic about man in his version of nature, but he is pessimistic about man in modern society. He was the father of what came to be called Romanticism. That's his worldview. So we've talked about rationalists, fideists, empiricists, deists. And now let's talk about the Romanticist. Romanticism is that philosophy which transcends the machine of time and space on the basis of human emotions. The worldview that sees what the Enlightenment is doing as creating a closed-off machine. And trying to transcend that, not on the basis of revelation, not on the basis of human reasoning, though that's, I think, subtly still accepted, but on the basis of human emotions. It is at its root a reaction to the Enlightenment's confidence in reason and progress in society. And one could say that Rousseau was the first postmodern before postmodernism was ever conceived. Interestingly, at the height of World War II, Bertrand Russell said that, quote, "At the present time, Hitler is an outcome of Rousseau, Roosevelt, and Churchill of Locke," end quote. So that's sort of the English-French breakdown. You see the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution. So 1789 and 1917, far apart, but representing the same other worldview other than the one in England and America. That is horribly oversimplified. But at any rate, that's what Russell sees in the 1940s. Well, let's look at where this starts for Rousseau in his thinking. Before he even gets to his theory on government, let's see about his worldview. The Discourse on the Origin of Inequality in 1755 was a response to a prize that was offered for anyone who could write the best essay on the relationship between scientific advancement and morality. Was the advance of science negatively affecting morals? And at first, he won, by the way, with this, the Discourse on the Origin of Inequality. His friends among the philosophers instantly celebrated along with him, until they actually read it carefully and realized that he was criticizing everything they were building upon. A bit like the Pharisees when they realized Jesus was talking about them. It was the same kind of thing. But unlike the hardened revolutionary of times to come, Rousseau begins his essay with two kinds of inequality. Let's put it over here on the left, because we're doing a storyboard here, a narrative a left to right thing about how something went down. Inequality. Two kinds. Let's put natural over here on the left, because that's embedded in nature. So here's the beginning, although he's not going to make any appeal to the scriptures. And over here on the right, let's put moral. It doesn't necessarily mean that as a compliment. Natural inequality, moral inequality. The former being simply the way it is by nature, and therefore not necessarily something to be altered. Now, as you get further on in Marx's theory, even that can become a situation to be altered. But anyway, the latter, moral inequality, is by establishment of customs among people. So there's deliberation there. Now, it's gradual, but it is nevertheless deliberate. It's, in a sense, unnatural, or at least it's a short step to say that's unnatural. So let's put that in parentheses. Parentheses just meaning, he's not saying that, but what I want to show you is that he has to say that. Which, if you're a naturalist, becomes immediately awkward. Because naturalism says that nature is all there is. Now, I'm not saying that Rousseau was a naturalist. In fact, Rousseau got into an argument with Voltaire over an earthquake that happened in Lisbon, in Portugal. And Rousseau was attributing it to either God or exonerating God. And Voltaire is saying, look, there's earthquakes over here to Christians. How come the earthquake didn't kill me? I'm an atheist. I'm shaking my fist at God. Where's God? Okay, so Rousseau's argument with Voltaire over that. Okay, so Rousseau does believe in supernature. He does believe in a God. Don't think he believes much in the scriptures because how he was turned off from the Calvinism of his hometown. But what's going to happen here is if I drift toward naturalism, even subtly, nature is all there is, or at least all that's worth talking about. Therefore, everything starts out natural. Wait a minute. ... If everything's natural, how can something be unnatural? We'll come back to that, but just heads up, antennas up on that. So moral inequality comes later. It's artificial. It's established among people. Now, to those who say that these two things actually overlap, because when people have superior talents and those people start to lead other people and there's economic stratification and so on, that's nature talking too. Rousseau heaps scorn at that. He says, if those who command are necessarily better men as if those who command are necessarily better men than those who obey. Okay? Now, that's interesting because there's a way to criticize stratification that is, in a sense, unnatural. But by that, we have a basis on which to criticize it, because we don't believe nature is all there is. We believe that there is a moral oughtness and an otherwise. And so if we say, that person shouldn't have got that job, or that person shouldn't be the president, or any number of things like that, we have a basis on which to criticize that. So I actually don't want to criticize Rousseau too much for saying that some men are leading who actually shouldn't be leading. That's not my criticism. But what Rousseau wants to do is deny that that has anything to do with nature. Because remember, Rousseau is going to blow up nature and say that's a good thing. So, Rousseau in his writing has to be subtle. He's writing to a particular audience. And no enlightened reader is going to have anything to do with this book if they realize that he is criticizing the Enlightenment. If he has a title like, Why You're All Wrong About Everything and Why People Were Okay 2 Centuries Ago, because Rousseau isn't saying that either. He wants to rewind the clock all the way to whatever. And so he ties together in the same sentences oftentimes accepted benefits with seldom considered pitfalls of the Enlightenment. He talks about how state of nature theorists are discovering this amazing moment in history when nature became subject to law, when the strong submitted to serve the weak. Sounds like a good thing, right? And the people to purchase imaginary ease at the expense of real happiness. So, at the beginning, he's talking about state of nature theory. In the same sentence, he's going, that moment when the strong submitted to serve the weak. Good thing, right? And people purchased an imaginary ease at the expense of real happiness. So by the end of the sentence, you're like, wait, what? Are you Wait a minute, you're against the Enlightenment? You're against civil society? Well, Rousseau does not contest the idea of a state of nature. Rather, he's going to claim that none of its theorists, Hobbes, Locke, the whole nine yards, none of its theorists have even scratched the surface of the state of nature. Rousseau is going to say, I'm going to show you what the state of nature actually is. Not only did the thinkers of the previous generations too loosely define their terms, but they, quote, have transferred to the state of nature ideas picked up in the bosom of society. In speaking of savages, they describe citizens, end quote. I think it's a pretty fair criticism. Now, if you flip the coin over, I don't think Rousseau is going to be able to show some caveman-type thing as you would today, but that's pretty much what he is going to do. I don't think he can do it from a biblical perspective. Yes, Adam was naked, but he was much smarter than you. Okay, I'm just going to say that. Okay, but so that's what he's going to go back to. But right here comes Rousseau's great equivocation. If there is a state of nature, then nature herself must be our instructor. So how is he going to use the word nature? In our Academy dictionary, we made sure that we had two definitions for this, and that there was a one and a two. And the one was really the number one. Namely, nature is the characteristic of a thing. In other words, when we say the natural law, what we really mean is the law of identity. A equals A. A thing is what it is and not something else. What thing? Anything. Any object has a nature. It has a way that it is, and it's not something else. Well, is that what he's talking about? If there's a state of nature, nature herself must be our instructor. So at first glance, he appears to make the right distinction between the truth which nature teaches, in other words, the way things really are. Hey, Josh, can you get me a glass of water? I'm having chalk coffee mixture in my throat. But he seems to make the right distinction between the truth which nature teaches, such that if there was any error that started to emerge, it would be my fault. It would be the human amplifier's addition to the book of nature. So he seems to make the right distinction between what nature teaches and what man adds later. But soon enough, it becomes clear that nature... Thank you. Nature in Rousseau comes to mean the nature that we have in us, such as we hear her. In other words, subjective nature. Subjective nature. Nature as what is inside of us bursting out. You can think of Freudian depth psychology. Nature in here. And that forms Rousseau's educational theory as much as it forms his politics and his religion. He states that he's not interested in a narrative of how society formed in terms of a moral or human story, nor is he interested in anything like naturalistic evolution, which, by the way, demonstrates again that this was a popular idea well over a century before Darwin. There were several different French thinkers that had, as early as the 1740s and 50s, written books promoting naturalistic evolution. Darwin just gave it a naturalist scheme, empirical data in his mind. But anyway, that's a side note. Rousseau says that's not what he's doing, but he actually has to do something like that because that's what they all did. But here is the famous noble savage. So when we go into progression here from natural, let's put this, let's call him the noble savage. Rousseau's not going to use the word savage in a negative way. He's going to use it in a positive way. And everything's going to flow. The story is going to flow this way. And at some point, man added something, the unnatural. Okay? So he's going to go back there. And he's going to introduce this character, the noble savage. In a real state of nature, don't listen to Hobbes, don't listen to Locke, in the real version, man lives equally as a beast. And the first implication of this is the same as in ancient Sparta. The strong survive, the weak do not. We might think that we excel them, but that's only through our ready-to-hand devices. If you put a modern man and a savage man face-to-face, the savage wins every time. And this is a good thing. And so right there, we can draw our first straight line from Rousseau to Nietzsche. I have it second because I'm doing that chronologically. But over there on the right, I have a chart, Rousseau's assumptions of a good nature. And when Rousseau has an assumption of good nature, he means three things by it. Natural equality, that's going to lead to Marx. Natural strength, that's what I just mentioned, that's going to go right into Nietzsche. And then natural interests inside, and that's going to lead to Dewey and that educational philosophy. I'll come back to that. But right now, let's do this first one, is that the savage wins every time. This kind of strength is a good thing that we gave up with society. And so you can draw a straight line from Rousseau to Nietzsche. As to health, it's very likely that civilization brings more new diseases than its advances in medicine can cure. So that the differences in longevity between European society and the most remote tribe are negligible. In other words, Rousseau is making the early form of the argument that off-the-gridders make today. And of course, there may be some truth to some of those things, but Rousseau is saying civilization itself is the problem. And it's a pretty sweeping statement. Our encounters with modern savages and with wild animals in our hunting shows us the absence of sickness. And that no physicians are needed even to heal what is injured. Time and the constitution of the body do all that. And so all that said, Rousseau finds fault with Hobbes' description of self-preservation in the state of nature. It's real. We have a self-interest instinct, self-preservation. But there's something else that's real that Hobbes neglected, and that is pity. Pity. That innate repulsion from seeing another being like oneself suffering. That's the way he defines it. An innate repulsion from seeing another being like oneself suffering. But it is society. And it is its competitive fixation that distracts us from empathy, that dissolves pity. And so from the spiritual to the physical, society disintegrates the true nature of man. Here's the true nature. Society disintegrates that true nature. Well, when does all this happen? What is this line right here? Where does all this go south? Well, it goes south the moment that man begins to think in such a way as distinguishes him from animals. To a point. He's not going to say it just like that, but then he's going to draw it out like that. So, Rousseau assumes that there is a difference between man and animals in reason. And he's not going to explicitly reject that. But then he says, because the mind depraves the senses, and when nature ceases to speak, the will still continues to dictate. So the mind is sort of wandering away from the emotions and they're supposed to go together. Well, I agree with that. They're supposed to go together. But you begin to wonder at the author's motive at this point. He says this, nature speaks to all animals and beasts obey her voice. Man feels the same impulse, but he at the same time perceives that he is free to resist or to acquiesce. And it is in the consciousness of this liberty that the spirituality of his soul chiefly appears. Now, he's not complaining at this point. He seems to refrain from condemnation until he arrives at this, in the French, I don't know how to pronounce this, but the English word perfectibility, it's spelled the same way except there with an E instead of a Y. But you can translate that improvement, or even a consciousness of progress. I think that's what Rousseau's really getting here with this idea of perfectibility. The consciousness of progress. He says, it is this faculty which, through by slow degrees, draws him out of his original condition, in which his days would slide away insensibly in peace and innocence. My days would be perfect, sitting around on the couch and sliding away into... Okay, so he doesn't have that in mind, but it still sounds funny. Okay, slide away insensibly in peace and innocence. That it is this faculty, this consciousness of progress, which in a succession of ages produces his discoveries and mistakes, his virtues and his vices, and in the long run renders him both his own and nature's tyrant. So reason is conscious of this perfectibility. I could do something different tomorrow than I did today. The animals never have that problem. It's a problem because it renders him both his own and nature's tyrant. Even languages, this is how they developed. Languages at first needed only to be the simple, what he calls the cry of nature. I'm sorry, but I can't help but thinking about that video with the hippies crying in the wilderness about the forest being stepped on and stuff like that. But that's what I'm thinking of. I can't help it. Okay? But languages only needed to be that. Yeah, maybe a little bit more than that. But it achieves the complexity of modern language only because that's what rhetoric requires to persuade the masses of their insanity. And so as people start to bump into each other and stuff, more and more words had to come out. You see what I'm doing right now? With my inflection and my gesture, I need to do that to push through what is wrong with this idiot who's touching my stuff. And so I had to come up with more symbols and blah, off that thing. What is the matter with you? Okay? So more demonstrative inflection and gesturing was itself a result of this increasing political conflict. At this point, you might begin to ask whether Rousseau's picture really differs much from Hobbes in the movement from the simple to the complex. See, the only difference is that the Frenchman here is lamenting this climb up from the jungle, whereas Hobbes approved of it. Now, he specifically contradicts Hobbes as to whether man is bad, and therefore whether that original state of nature is bad. But this does not save his romanticism from creating its own statism. That's one of the things I want to press this point home as well in the Enlightenment, is when you look at political theory, one of the lessons of these early great political theorists of the secular world is that whether I line up as an individual or a collectivist, a naturalist or a supernaturalist, a rationalist or an empiricist, a fideist or a dogmatist, whether I line up on one of the other extremes, that doesn't necessarily save me from statism. Because there may be some more general reason you got there that you might not be considering. Now, Rousseau, by the way, I'm so intrigued how many libertarians are basically romanticists of Rousseau's ilk. So wouldn't it be nice if we just, and fill in the blank with all the stuff I just said, okay? How many libertarians talk exactly like this, even though it is clear to most political theorists of all stripes that communism finds much of its wellspring in the modern world, not only through Marx, but all the way back to Rousseau. Now, you can't so easily refute Rousseau by looking at this book with its words, with its big words, with it being printed in modern society, presumably being read by literate people, and that being the point of him writing it. Why are you writing this then, Rousseau? And I noticed that you're actually using the tools of the very social structure that you're calling a fraud. Man, this is really bad today. So in a sense, Rousseau is against society, but he is for it reading his book. I'm against society. Read my book first, though. It reminds me of a really funny Eddie Murphy skit on Saturday Night Live, and he's a reggae singer. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's okay, I probably shouldn't say it. But it is exactly the same thing. I mean, it is exactly the same thing. It's marketed to a white audience. He's like, kill the white people, but buy my record first. That is Rousseau applied to that music. Anyway, so... But you can't make that argument against Rousseau that easily because he has an escape hatch. Somewhere between God's providence and proportion in this life, he has an escape hatch. Here's a quote that gives us a clue. He says, "It was in consequence of a very wise providence that the faculties which man potentially enjoyed were not to develop themselves except as there offered occasions to exercise them." So just take reason. God gave reason for man to use, but only in proportion for you to exercise them on their right thing, at their right stage of development, lest they should be superfluous or troublesome to him when he did not yet want them, or tardy and useless when he did. Stop right there. Whose children want to exercise their reason when they're not ready to use them? Come on. Spoken by a guy who, even if he did have kids, abandoned them, which I'll get to at the very end of the thing, and explains a lot about his theory. But in other words, Rousseau can find reason useful, he can find society useful, he can find reason in society good for humanity if it develops in proportion to original nature. But how should we decide on that? Rousseau calls the golden rule of Jesus that sublime maxim of rational justice. So he's for that. And it's pretty clear that in his conception, nature obeys the golden rule while the Enlightenment has made war against it. And so that's the escape hatch. Society can work if it's in proportion to nature as I see it. I wouldn't say it like that, but that's what it is. And if it's not already blatantly obvious, there is within society and its narrative of progress the twin engines of the rise of inequality, namely reason and competition. So let's put up here on this progression, and I actually should have put this line out more. Let's forget about that distinction here. Just put the line when society happens. Society on the right, and we'll put the twin pillars over here that uphold society and its progress, reason and competition. And so in society, I'll put in parentheses up here all the way at the top, progress. Progress happens, society forms, to the degree that reason and competition are acting together. So of the first, reason, he says, quote, "It is reason that engenders self-love." Notice the hint, not so subtle, of the emergent guys today. It is reason that engenders self-love and reflection that strengthens it. It is reason that makes man shrink into himself. It is reason that makes him keep aloof from everything that can trouble or afflict him. It is philosophy that destroys his connections with other men. It is consequence of her dictates that he mutters to himself at the sight of another in distress, "You may perish, for aught I care, I am safe." End quote. Reason did all that, except for what I just said. See, rational reflection dissolves nature's pity. Except for my books, reflected the author of such a thesis. Now, most interestingly, erotic love is both necessary to preservation and the downfall of man. If you're a lady listening to this and you have previously liked Rousseau, prepare to not like him. What is physical in the sexual relationship is a given. What is moral in it is not. And again, he's just using the word moral to mean conventions and so on. The notion of love that was attached to this act was invented, quote, "by the woman with great care and address in order to establish their empire and secure command to that sex which ought to obey," end quote. Oh! That was so un-French of him. You hear what he's saying? Marriage is the invention of women to dominate men, and enough older men running society cooperated in exchange for easier sex. That's what he just said. So maybe it was a little French. But anyway, but all the ideas that are moral ideas, the ideas of beauty, the ideas of virtue in a woman, feminine virtues, are simply constructs of society of which savage men were absolutely incapable. And thus, every manner of sexual perversion is blamed on the advance of reason. See, even beauty is in the eye of the socially constructed beholder. Okay? Feminine virtues, femininity, that is a prop of the strong to keep everybody in their place. Marx didn't come up with anything new, in a sense. But Rousseau has to explain away the competition for females that occurs everywhere in the animal kingdom. Because, of course, that wouldn't be happening. And the noble savage didn't have that problem. Noble savage never walked up to a counter in Walmart and saw Cosmo magazine and said, "Yes, that's the value. That is a product of society." Now, there's a truth in that. You see, every lie is a twisted truth. But at every point, hopefully, you can see this as the antithesis to Calvinistic theology. To the undiscerning, it might appear as all that Rousseau is doing is contradicting the state of nature theorists. He's arguing against Locke. He's arguing against Hobbes and the progress narrative of the Enlightenment. But read this carefully and you'll see it. He asks this question, comparing again the noble savage, the state of nature, to modern society. He says, of what service can beauty be where there is no love? What will wit avail people who don't speak? Or cunning those who have no business? Authors are constantly crying out that the strongest would oppress the weakest. But let them explain what they mean by the word oppression. End quote. So what is he doing here? He's saying that not only is it the case that the simpler we are, the less occasion for doing evil. You see what he's saying in all that? With beauty and wit and cunning, those would have no place if we were just naked in a hut with our own and not bothering about all of this where we get all these bad ideas. The simpler we are, the less occasion for doing evil. But more than that, the simpler we are, the more innocent we are. Now do you see it? Do you see the absolute contrast to Calvinism? So what is behind all this? What the Christian tradition had always called sin and located within, in the nature of man, this noble savage is teaching us actually comes from without. In fact, sin is social. Evil is institutional. It's like a virus. We're like scenery, and it corrupts us. Well, now on to the romanticist narrative. How this happened? What's the actual progression? Well, he says, the first man who ever enclosed a piece of ground and took it into his head to say, this is mine, and found people simple enough to believe him, was the real founder of civil society, end quote. And Rousseau says somebody should have come along and responded, beware of listening to this imposter. You are lost if you forget that the fruits of the earth belong equally to all of us and the earth itself to nobody. By the way, I can hear in that not just a lashing out against that first caveman that said, this is mine. I hear a lashing out against the Christ that Abraham Kuyper says over every square inch of creation, this is mine. I think Rousseau has a problem with somebody else besides himself having something. That's what I think. So you can see another straight line right here drawn between Rousseau and Marx. So that's that other one. Nature equally dispersed. Perfect equality, and he means something different than what Locke and Montesquieu meant. Now, before the unhappy accident of the first competition, he said, quote, man's first feeling was that of his existence, his first care that of preserving it. The productions of the earth yielded him all the assistance he required. Instinct prompted him to make use of them. So, even on the self-interest principle, in Rousseau's thought, nature keeps everything to a pretty modest sphere. But here's the problem. Even on Rousseau's account, nature obviously slipped. It's like the same problem with the Big Bang if you're a naturalist. The law of inertia. Well, let's call this the law of social inertia. How'd it go wrong? Nature's good. Okay. How'd it go wrong? There seemed to be a glitch in her system, even if the nature lover doesn't appreciate calling her a system, which sounds artificial, contrived, unnatural, opposite of nature. Well, Rousseau would say, well, there were honest enough confusions that happened. Let's not call them disputes yet. And they necessitated councils and then alliances between herds. Let's not call them tribes yet. Competitions arose in proportion to the strength of the passions. So again, food and sex and whatever else. Not yet prestige, not yet things like that. And so the rise of the family and the fortress, were simultaneous. The weaker finding it easier to imitate such boundaries than to try to cross them. They're the weaker. I'm not going to mess with the strong, but that's a pretty cool fortress and his wife's hot, so I'll build a little hut and get somebody, you know, whatever. Easier than war. So within these dividing walls, gender differences emerged. Within these dividing walls, gender roles emerged. Whereas before, there was nothing to distinguish their way of life. 11th grade, 10th grade biology, toddler knowledge, what? By the way, if anybody laughs at that, later on, Marxism actually tries to eradicate those. They're all social constructs. What do you mean by all? Just out of curiosity. I will never forget sitting in a classroom at BSU, 2005, taking a class on educational theory. And I'll never forget, because all these kids wanted, they're kids. All these people wanted to become teachers. And they were, the teacher or somebody was telling the famous story of the experiment of the little infant boy and the infant girl, and they can, just enough where they can crawl. And one side of the room, it's a singular long room, one side is painted blue, and there's army stuff everywhere, and footballs, and armies, and swords, and all that stuff, and spiders, and whatever. And on the other side of the room is pink, and teacups, and all that good stuff. And they mixed them up, shuffled them around, the boy and the girl, and every time, the boy went that way, and the girl went that way. And one of the students said to the other students, well, we're going to do something about that. And of course, my swastika detector started going off, you know, like the bat signal. Bing, bing, bing. I'm like, what the? I'm like, really? In Boise, stinking Idaho? Are you kidding me? Just thought I'd rat somebody out. Anyway, but that's it. So let's not laugh too hard at that, because I'm telling you, that idea does need to go that far. So he still keeps telling his story. The great diversities of power rising, communities branching out, then created rank and lot, and then the divides only multiplied in very predictable ways after that. Differences in classes, differences in nations only exacerbated men's suspicions of each other, leading to more bloodshed, which then perpetuates the same escalating cycle. So it just goes on and on and on, but of course all of it's coming from the outside. Well, the needle to the whole balloon of Rousseau's worldview at this point is this. Take any one point of departure. I kind of hinted at it already. And ask Rousseau the question. Was that problem, whether it's the origin of it or something along the way, is that problem natural or unnatural? If it's natural, then it is a portion of that nature which Rousseau is committed to calling good. If it's unnatural, then we have to ask, what nature caused this nature from the outside? Is it a good nature or a bad nature? And so, you see, he's forced to move the answer that Christians have always given one step back. And in fact, he's avoided the problem of saying evil in any objective way. He is left with an unnatural nature, which is a square circle world that one cannot really live in with any consistency or satisfaction. So my basic, you know, blurb, one phrase, one term argument against Rousseau's worldview is unnatural nature. Rousseau's problem is that he must be committed to unnatural nature. And that's ultimately the problem with any naturalist that doesn't want to descend toward nihilism. And we'll see that next year, how naturalism leads to nihilism. But any naturalist who is not okay with that is still committed to unnatural nature. Things I want to criticize in nature, but nature's all there is, so what's the basis of my criticism? Okay, so let's go to his book on politics, The Social Contract. Still in that first book, Rousseau moves from description to norm. He's tearing down the existing state of nature theory, he's replacing it with his own. He says, because, this is his origin of the state, because in the first case, the right of conquest, being in fact no right at all, it could not serve as a foundation for any other right. The conqueror and the conquered ever remaining with respect to each other in a state of war. Now, I agree with that. Conquest and power are not a sufficient foundation. That is well said. But rather than return to the Christian view, which had the law standing eternally over victor and vanquished, over sovereign and subjects, over constitutional law and statutory law, Rousseau, instead of returning to the Christian view which addresses that, is driven to wipe the slate of history clean. So 7 years later, he writes his more final thought on political theory, The Social Contract, in 1762. I'm not going to bore you with the breakdown of the book. Let's just get into some of the facts so we can get through this time. Book one does contain 9 chapters, and what he does is he begins in the primitive tracing it all the way through the customary transition from the state of nature to the civil state. So, all he's doing right now is the same progression, but instead of society, let's call it the state. Now that's the question. Or the social contract. He is not going to differ from Locke much in using the words liberty and equality as being inherent to man in his original state. That's not where the disagreement's going to be. He goes from the individual to the family. And he says the family is primal in its nature and in the state of nature, but only so far as they need each other. To the degree that there is no natural necessity, any bond between the individual parties is only voluntary. Now, notice the analogy Rousseau makes. He says, quote, "The family is then, if you will, the primitive model of political societies. The chief is the analog of the father, while the people represent the children. And all being born free and equal, alienate their liberty only for their own advantage." So, if that analogy holds across the board, then it would seem that every group of people, because the people are represented by the children, every people comes of age, so to speak. And so you have a pretext for revolution whenever. Whenever it's no longer useful, advantageous in that analogy. Now, he moves the same way political theory had from individual, household, slave. As to slaves, Aristotle was right about one thing. Slaves are slaves by nature, but only because their chains have altered their nature. Isn't that interesting? That Rousseau has a category for an altered nature. He has a category for it, but only when he wants to make one of his points. He says, quote, "The first slaves are made such by force. Their cowardice kept them in bondage." So you see what he's doing. He's getting under the skin. He's agitating his reader. He's saying, you are the slaves. Rise up, you cowards. Okay? First slaves were made such by force. Their cowardice kept them in bondage. And that's interesting because he says at the very beginning of the book, his famous phrase, man was born free and everywhere he is in chains. Man was born free, but everywhere he is in chains. And I think by everywhere he means everywhere, even in high society in France. At what point then do legitimate authority and the just use of force come into play? Well, one thing between the two is absolutely sure, and on this point he's right, but he has no basis for it. Might does not make right. Force does not beget authority, however far back the force was exerted. Just as Rousseau appears to make more sense than the English theorist on this point, he only takes Locke's idea of consent, and he turns those foundations completely inside out. Here's how he starts down that road. He says, "To say that a man gives himself for nothing is to say what is absurd and inconceivable. Such an act is illegitimate and invalid." So you're going to say, giving up a right is illegitimate, invalid. But you'd be asking, on what basis? On what basis? "For the simple reason that he who performs it is not in his right mind. To say the same thing of a whole nation is to suppose a nation of fools. And madness does not confer rights." Okay, I can agree with that. Where consent is insane, there's no real authority. And beyond that, he says, one cannot rightfully renounce one's own liberty. Here's his reason, though. Not because it's a right or a duty that has been given by God. He says, because without the free will, there is no ground for morality. Again, the flight from Calvinism. But what is legitimate authority? And what is legitimate force? If it is the sovereign will that they have to answer to, that they terminate on. Rousseau seems to be saying throughout that the will is the last right. The will, the individual's will, is the highest court of appeals. Except that the will has no right to relinquish this right. Let me say that again, because it's just like Locke's contradiction, it's just a different mistake. So, one ultimate mistake, same, but then they play out in two different ways. He seems to be saying throughout his book that the will is the last right, except that the will has no right to relinquish this right. So, what is supreme? The will. So, can the will just vote away their freedom? no, he has no right to do that. And his reason is because that is insane. That is madness. He's not in his right mind. We have to help him. And then famously he says at the end, we have to force people to be free. Huh? Okay. Well, it's no secret that in Rousseau, liberty gives way to equality. He says, quote, "In truth, laws are always useful to those with possessions and harmful to those who have nothing, from which it follows that the social state is advantageous to men only when all possess something and none has too much," end quote. So law can only be just if everybody has an equal amount of stuff. And behind all this, there's the end product of the state, which he calls the general will, which you have to force people to be free. Free from their circumstances as it develops. All people have the right to decent housing. Well, man, if they have the right, why stop there? Why not say all people have the right to luxurious housing? I mean, as long as no one's paying the bill, why not? Crime and punishment is reducible to the economic dimension of nature, well before Marx. He says, quote, "There is no evildoer who could not be made good for something," end quote. Interesting. In fact, as things are more equal, the motive for people to commit crimes to begin with is reduced. Remember, social evil comes from without. And if things are more equal, people won't commit as many crimes. He says in a well-governed state, there are few punishments, not because there are many pardons, but because criminals are rare. It is when a state is in decay that the multitude of crimes is a guarantee of impunity, end quote. So everything that becomes liberalism comes from his romanticism. Now let's end with the upshot. You could say that liberalism, in its modern dimension, is a conjunction of Locke's liberty and equality with Rousseau's romanticism, hyperjet, subjective nature applied to liberty and equality. You could say that it's a conjunction of Locke and Rousseau. But let's end with the upshot here. As radically different as the English and French seem, yet on the question of what government is, the Enlightenment theorists spoke with one voice. And here's how Rousseau put it. What then is the government? An intermediary body established between the subjects and the sovereign for their mutual communication. A body charged with the execution of the laws and the maintenance of freedom, both civil and political. Yeah, end quote. What he means is a creation of man. For all the reasons I give you in my book, man creates government. Translation, man created government. Again, Rousseau and the French are going to agree with Locke and the English on that point. It is as if Rousseau is almost aware, painfully aware, of the problem of defining government's nature apart from revelation. He says it in another way. Listen to this. Quote, "To discover the rules of society that are best suited to nations, there would need to exist a superior intelligence who could understand the passions of men without feeling any of them, who had no affinity with our nature but knew it to the full, whose happiness was independent of ours, but who would nevertheless make our happiness his concern, who would be content to wait for the fullness of time, for a distant glory, and to labor in one age to enjoy the fruits of another." In other words, gods, in the plural, would need to be given or to give men laws. Isn't that interesting? Gods. Would he just describe God, but he preferred to say gods? Come on, man. And so for all of that, it's not worth turning back on the road to Geneva. He's almost aware. It's right under his nose, and he just explicitly rejects it. Last point, his educational theory. He writes that book called Emile. It's a novel. And right here, let's draw our last straight line, a line from Rousseau's view of the nature of a child in education and the later philosophy of John Dewey. The main character of his novel, Emile, was modeled after an orphan boy, presumably because of his own experience after his mother had died and his father had been exiled after a short time tutoring him. Rousseau begins by opposing an early exposure to books in the story. And instead, he replaces books with having the child come into contact with the real world of experience. And this preference of experience over books mirrors his preference for nature over supernature. subjective over the authoritatively objective. Don't read those books, at least not too early, until you've experienced, in other words, till you and your experience has your presupposition set. And let's call what emerges from this book a child-centered educational philosophy. So let's draw on this circle the last thing. If you project it this way, now let's put a diaper here to show the origins of it. Child-centered education. I'm going to draw arrows coming out of this child to show that that's what we want. We want his experience, not an authority over him. Okay? Child-centered education. This is the widely used label for it, and so it's entirely fair. So, already seen the assumption. Rousseau's assumption is that nature is good, and so it is here. He says, everything is good as it leaves the hands of the author of things. Everything degenerates in the hands of man. So, negative socialization is what corrupts a child. That's what he's getting at. Negative socialization is what corrupts a child. And so one author summarizes his approach in this way. Two paragraphs left, but these are juicy, so let's just go with these. Quote, the challenge is to place Emile in a natural environment in which his intrinsic natural goodness will grow and develop without being tainted by a corrupt society, end quote. So here's the alternatives. Here's the battle. Alternatives are between a book-centered, authority-enabling, nature-repressing, classical curriculum where the student is a passive receptor, or else a child-centered, experience-based, nature-enhancing atmosphere. And even in this latter, we have to be careful. Any atmosphere which is prepared at all becomes an instrument of controlling the will of the child and molding it to the dictates of the prior society. So no preparation at all, except for mine. Except for my preparationless preparation. So what is needed is a non-social, self-directed environment. And of course, all this does is to produce a rather artistic and tyrannical narcissist. And the greatest among them will actually become the tyrant with a capital T. Last point, and this is good. Here's the upshot. The child should not be pressured into reading. He should not be pressured into absorbing abstract facts and figures which are quite irrelevant to him. So that's that point, nature's interest. What is he interested in? And here Rousseau is going to inform Dewey. Now, he's going to disagree with Dewey about something else. On the issue of socialization, Rousseau and Dewey are polar opposites. Rousseau wants them kept separate. Dewey wants them together so he can create an explicit communist state. But on the issue of what we might call natural interest, the romanticism of Rousseau comes through Dewey into virtually all modern education theory, including most homeschoolers, or non-theory. Now, here it is. As always, every lie is a twisted truth. There is a truth that we learn best what we love most. There is a kind of gravitation between the soul on fire with curiosity for a thing and the nature of that thing, so that the thing we love begins to reveal its secrets to us at warp speed. That is all true. And it's an important thing for educators to remember. However, there are also many things which a human being just must know. My child's not up to that. My child can't handle that. My child is not interested in that. He's going to die. Hitler wants to eat your child. There is a body of essentials for education without which the soul is not shaped as a properly human soul. And whenever we sacrifice that body of objective truth for the subordinate truth about the subject's interests, at that point and to that degree, we are mistaking the children for the educators and the parents and teachers as the pathetic facilitators of their sovereign nature. Last paragraph. This is funny. It is certainly worth noting, not this part, but the next part, certainly worth noting that this man who so famously appealed for permissiveness toward children abandoned his own children. And it was said that the father of a child on whom Rousseau had applied these principles as a tutor, this father later on wrote a letter to Rousseau saying, "Congratulations, my son is now an idiot."